Here on Radio 4 FM, our Book of the Week continues with Tracy Thorn reading her memoir, Bedsit Disco Queen. She's most famous as the singer of Everything But the Girl, the band she created with her husband Ben Watt over 30 years ago. But Tracy Thorn was first awakened to the music scene as a suburban teenager, drawing on the defiance of the punk scene to just pick up a guitar and start a band.
All of a sudden, it seemed as though everyone I knew was forming a band. Like the biggest playground craze of all time, it swept through the schools of suburbia, offering an escape route to every nerdy, bullied kid who'd never cut it on the sports field. Turn your back for 5 minutes and yet another alliance had been formed at the school bus stop or in the art room, and the fun of thinking up another name for a band would begin.
You got me feeling so happy.
The Marine Girls began as just me and Gina in my bedroom, playing the wafer-thin little songs I had written. We played quietly. After all, it was only my guitar and a drum machine, and Gina sang quietly, and I still didn't really like being overheard. In September, our friend Jane Fox joined the band on bass. Jane recalls now the fabulously casual manner in which she was recruited. Tracy just said, "Why don't you join? What do you want to play?" Despite all of us having a solid grounding in recent punk and post-punk groups, we had apparently not bought into the convention that bands needed a drummer, and we would never in fact acquire one. What became our trademark and a statement of our nonconformism started from the simple practicality that we didn't know a girl who had a drum kit. And we had by now decided we would be a girl group. All the other bands we knew were either groups of boys or groups of boys with a token girl. But we had an inkling that the only way to be in charge was to do it without the boys. When Gina missed a rehearsal one day, Jane's sister Alice stood in on vocals, and so we became four. Alice was 2 years younger than us, and so only 15 years old, and she sang with a kind of deadpan blankness, an affectless cool, that was in direct contrast to the often emotional lyrics written by me and later by Jane. Her delivery gave us a harder edge than we might otherwise have had, and made us sound defiantly indie. In March 1981, the Marine Girls did our first gig at Bulls Park College in Hartford. And a week later, we got our first review in a Hartford fanzine, which said, "They all have nice voices and use them well, especially Tracy." I couldn't say so, but more and more I wanted to sing my own songs. And yet the democracy of the band meant I sometimes had to hand them over to Alice. It was a completely buried issue, never brought out into the open. And so, as these things do, it simmered and festered and would ultimately become the weak point along which the band would fracture. But for now, it seemed impossible to bring up any grievances or problems because we were on something of a roll and coming to the attention of more and more people. John Peel had started playing tracks from our cassette, Beach Party, on his show, and inevitably we had been noticed by someone from a real proper indie label, Mike Allway from Cherry Red, and were unwittingly approaching the end of our period of total independence. Through August and September of 1981, having just left school, we started having meetings with Mike to discuss signing to Cherry Red Records, and with Theo Chalmers of their publishing department to talk about a publishing deal. If you'd asked me what a publishing deal was, I wouldn't have had a clue, but I don't think we admitted to that level of ignorance in front of anyone. But Theo at Cherry Red must have been quite persistent and persuasive, and by September we were close to a deal. My diary says that on the 22nd of September, a contract from Theo arrives, thick and confusing and very official looking. During that summer, we played our first gigs in London. We rehearsed hard and would tape the rehearsals to listen back to. Jane's dad worked for the Lee Valley Water Board, and allowed us to rehearse after school at their social club, setting up on the foot-high stage while he watched us from the back of the room and let us have an orange juice from behind the bar. The very first London gig was on the 27th of August at the Moonlight Club in West Hampstead. There was an element of defiance involved in all of it. If the boys had always thought that they were the ones who really understood the music scene, we had proved to them that we could take it and make of it something of our own and gain a wider kudos than any of them. So although I was terrified to go on, so terrified that I was physically sick, it was the defiance that won through. Possibly without realising it, I was also in a state of anxiety about the changes that were about to occur in my life. I was leaving home only a week after my birthday and going up to Hull University to study English. Despite all the music, the DIY industriousness and the gathering attention we were getting, it never occurred to me not to go to university. Being in a band wasn't a job, it was just being in a band. It was what you did. I'd still have to have a proper job at some point, and given that I had no idea what I wanted that to be, I was happy to put the decision off for 3 years. It's the 3rd of October, 1981, and along with thousands of other soon-to-be students from across the country, I'm leaving home to go to university. I'm the first of my family to do this, and so it's a significant and symbolic event for all of us. I pack my clothes and guitar, but no amp, and stereo and record collection into the back of my dad's car, and we drive up to Hull. Just this once, let me tell you, you're the sweetest thing. Love in every song I sing. Music in my ears and everything. A couple of other girls from school have come up to Hull, so in the bar I scan the room for familiar faces, but can see no one. I start queuing for a drink when an announcement comes ringing out over the tannoy system. If Tracy of the Marine Girls is in the building, will she please come to reception? Now, I'd be lying if I implied that this was a complete shock. I had already been told earlier in the summer by Mike Allway that a label mate of mine on Cherry Red, a solo artist called Ben Watt, was going to Hull at the same time, though I barely took it in at all. Mike had pointed out Ben's photo on the wall at the Cherry Red offices, but again, I took no notice. And he also gave me a copy of Ben's first single, Cant, and I still took no notice. Hearing this message broadcast, I realise it is probably Ben trying to track me down, and he suddenly seems like a possible kindred spirit in this hellish place full of prats in rugby shirts. I make my way up the stairs to reception, and there he is, leaning against a pillar. After all these years, can I still picture him standing there and recapture my first glimpse of him? I can't exactly. The memory is there, but slightly out of reach or blurred. A first impression buried underneath so many later impressions.
Meetings arranged, they say never work out. I say we've proven wrong without doubt. I can't remember now just what we said. No, I never could have guessed what lay ahead. As I ran towards you up the stairs, did a voice in my ear cry away?
But there was something striking about his face, something exotic. He wasn't entirely English looking. I immediately guessed they were genes from somewhere else, and later found out that they were Romany Gypsy. Above all, he seemed unfamiliar. Do you know who I am? I think you're probably Ben Watt. That's right. Have you got your guitar with you? I have, of course, though not literally. I have by now learned to leave it behind when I go out in the evening. We go back down to the bar and have a couple of drinks, and share some thoughts about records and students, until eventually Ben suggests we go back to his house. It turns out that he has also been allocated a shared room in a student house, only 3 doors away from mine in Cranbrook Avenue, so we walk back there together. It's only October, but it's already freezing, and an icy wind blows across the exposed car park, as it will do for the rest of the winter. I'm wearing a thin anorak, 1950s-style rolled-up jeans, and bare feet inside my pumps. He teases me about how ridiculously underdressed I am, as he will do for the rest of the winter. I've known him for about an hour, and already he doesn't seem so unfamiliar. We get to his house and go up to his room. Bear in mind that Ben only arrived that afternoon, and so has been here for exactly the same amount of time as me, that is, about 5 hours. But already, his room has been completely transformed and looks nothing like mine. His desk, the piece of furniture theoretically so central to a student's bedroom, if not their very existence, has been put safely out of the way on top of the wardrobe. In its place is a huge trunk, on top of which sits Ben's record deck, with two enormous speakers on either side. I've never seen speakers that big before. I hadn't realised they were an option for the home listener. The entire wall above his bed is papered with photos and posters, stuck edge to edge with no wall showing between. Pictures of bands, film posters, and a large black and white photo of his girlfriend. I know why I am here, and so I waste no time, and immediately start looking through his record collection, where I find my two current favourite albums, Vic Goddard and the Durruti Column. Ben seemed older than me, infinitely more self-confident and assured, which he wasn't, and at first, after he interrupted a lecturer to correct a mistake the poor man had just made in his introduction to Beckett, I mistook him for an intellectual, which he certainly wasn't. The displacement of the desk by the record player in his room should have alerted me to that fact, but it took me a while to realise that all he cared about was music, and it wasn't until I noticed he was choosing his courses purely on the basis of which ones required the least reading that I finally let go of my initial misapprehension that he was cleverer than me. So we would never share a passion for reading long Victorian novels, but at least he liked Vic Goddard. Both of us were making quiet, minimalist music, but within the context of rock gig venues, where playing at low volume was in itself a confrontational thing to do. Music journalist Simon Reynolds quotes Stuart Moxham of Young Marble Giants replying to a heckler who demanded some rock and roll with the words, "Anyone can do that. They're doing it all over town, but we want to do this." And so, when Ben and I met, we clutched at the little we had in common in our music, realising immediately how much we had in common in our attitudes. We don't need
Tracy Thorne was reading from her memoir Bedsit Disco Queen, abridged by Alison Joseph and produced by Allegra McElroy. Brian Friel is considered by many as the greatest living English-speaking playwright, acclaimed for works including Dancing at Lunasa and Translations. Next week, five of Friel's short stories are read by Adrian Dunbar, specially for Radio 4 Extra. In the first, an outsider decides the best way to integrate is to instigate a poaching competition.
Keen faces were turned towards the contestants. Small boys climbed onto the parapet of the iron bridge. As the seconds ticked past, the shouting of the spectators fell, faded into whispers, and died altogether. The Scalper and Quigley looked sharply at one another, and the duel began.
The Brian Friel stories on Radio 4 Extra start on Monday morning at 11 and again at 9 in the evening.